You may know about the Howard Gardner Multiple Intelligent Charter School in Scranton, named in Gardner's honor. Originally founded as the Children's Learning Workshop in 1975, the school adopted his name in 2005 to reflect its curriculum based on his theory of multiple intelligences. Howard Gardner is best known for that theory of multiple intelligences, which argues that the human intellect isn't just one fixed ability reflected in, say, an IQ score, but a range of at least 8 different abilities. And though he has retired from teaching, Harvard's School of Education welcomes Gardner as Hobbs Research Professor of Cognition and Education. In the introduction to his study, Creating Minds, he writes, "Though parents should not have a favorite child, authors ought to be permitted to have a favorite book. I've written well over 20 books, but in many ways, Creating Minds is my favorite. Preparation of the book was a labor of love. I reveled as I dove into the rich repositories of information about the 7 master creators whom I was describing, examining primary sources, reading biographies and notebooks of Sigmund Freud, watching the films of dancer Martha Graham, poring over the drafts of T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, listening again and again to Igor Stravinsky's path-breaking compositions, looking at sketches for Pablo Picasso's boldest canvases, attempting to piece together the many fragments of autobiography left by Mahatma Gandhi, and puzzling over Albert Einstein's most important scientific papers. It was like being enrolled in 7 elective college or graduate school courses. As a studious youngster growing up in Scranton, Pennsylvania, in the 1950s, I loved to read. What captured my interest most were biographies and histories drawn from many lands, but focused particularly on Western Europe, from which my family came, and the United States, our new home. I was curious about these figures and their creativity." Gardner opens his book, Creating Minds, by pointing to Tom Stoppard's comedy, Travesties. First performed in 1974, it's set in Zurich during the First World War. The plot ostensibly revolves around the efforts of Henry Carr, a minor official in the British consulate, and an amateur actor, to stage Oscar Wilde's turn-of-the-century farce, The Importance of Being Earnest. But the glitter of Travesties comes from the portraits of historical personalities who happen to be living in Switzerland at the time, and whose activities are being recalled many years later by an aging, forgetful, and self-congratulatory Carr. Though Stoppard does not hesitate to mix fact and fancy, it is indeed true that many individuals of historical moment congregated in war-spared Zurich during what was universally called the Great War. Carr reminisces Zurich during the war, refugees, spies, exiles, painters, and poets, writers, radicals of all kinds were there. Stoppard's play centers on 3 of these figures: a little-known Irish writer, James Joyce, an obscure Russian revolutionary, V.I. Lenin, and a half-crazed Romanian artist intellectual, Tristan Tzara, who is fashioning Dadaism, an aesthetic brand of nihilism. The exiles go about their business, respectively writing the great novel, planning the Russian Revolution, and redefining art, politics, and life. As members of the audience, we can view Travesties not only as an amusing farce about makeshift theater, but also as a backstage glimpse at a trio of individuals in the course of creating what would come to be regarded as the modern era. Words of Howard Gardner from his study, Creating Minds. Now, we might just look down the list of abilities Howard Gardner lists in his theory of multiple intelligences and come to see Steve Martin as a quintessential example of Gardner's theory. We find that Steve Martin is quite something in many ways. Number one on the Howard Gardner list of multiple intelligences is linguistic intelligence, defined as a sensitivity to words and the functions of language. Well, Steve Martin has at least 14 books to his credit, including 3 novels, one about the New York art world. Third on Gardner's list is musical ability, the ability to produce and appreciate rhythm, pitch, and timbre. As we know, Steve Martin has been a musician much of his life. He's performed with the bluegrass group the Steep Canyon Rangers, and he co-wrote the music and wrote the book and developed the story for the bluegrass-themed musical Bright Star alongside Edie Brickell. He is a Grammy Award winner. Another 2 on the list, spatial and bodily kinesthetic abilities, capacities to perceive the visual, spatial world accurately and perform transformations on those perceptions, the ability to control one's body movements and handle objects skillfully. Well, you might say, not Steve Martin. Well, yes, as an actor, Steve Martin has had to draw on spatial and bodily kinesthetic abilities, even though he has frequently used klutziness and bumbling behavior as a central element of his comedy. In fact, he is widely considered a master of physical comedy that's actually rooted in precision and exactitude. And there are other abilities on the list, but Steve Martin is a prototype of what the Gardner list is trying to convey to us about the multiple intelligences. Steve Martin has been curious about all those matters, about how, for example, scientists and artists can both be brilliant in different ways. Well, Steve Martin decided to write a play to have fun while engaging in what Albert Einstein might call a thought experiment. What if a young artist and a young scientist walked into a bar? He titles his piece Picasso at the Lapin Argyle, and we are invited into the hilarity of watching a meeting between, of all people, Albert Einstein and Pablo Picasso. The show opens tomorrow evening in Wellsboro, presented by Hamilton Gibson Productions and Gabe Hochvag, as a member of the Hamilton Gibson board, is the director. We had a chance to speak by Zoom with him about the ensemble and about the play itself.
Hamilton Gibson Productions is a community performing arts organization. Started originally in a storage barn. They did a musical, got a bunch of people together. They built a set. They built costumes. They figured it out. And they did a show. And they went, that was fun. Let's do it again. And so 30 plus years later, we have our own theater. We produce about 6 to 8 stage plays and musicals a year. We have a children's choir that performs twice a year and goes on tour. We have Acting Up, which is a seniors theater reading group. And we have an improv club. And you get the idea. We're just trying to find as many ways to give people the opportunity to perform here in our community. So it's our community telling stories to our community.
The wonderful part is it does seem that when you talk about that Mickey Rooney, Judy Garland, let's get some and put on a production attitude, that it really did take root. And many of you, or some of you, are still there, right?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, Thomas Putnam started the whole thing years ago, and he's our artistic director, and he's told us he's not going anywhere soon. But yeah, some people have been involved since they were children, and are, as adults, are still active and involved with Hamilton Gibson.
We always like to know how a season is put together when we talk to theater people. And so if you would tell us a little bit about this season and how we got to Picasso and Einstein.
So Thomas Putnam meets with an artistic planning committee. And what he does is he'll just throw a bunch of scripts on the table. We'll throw around ideas for what might be the unifying theme of the season. We'll basically talk, read, react. People come with new material. Hey, you haven't read this yet. Take a look at this, or it reminded me of something. And over the course of several months, we kind of just consolidate the possibilities. And then from there, Thomas, as artistic director, says, okay, this is what the year's season is going to be. So this year, 2026, is about the power of art to heal and improve lives. It's a good one, right? And if you look at the season, you'll see that theme playing out. It's about art, it is about community, it's about, well, it's a whole lot of interesting things, including in the early fall, we're going to be doing in rotation The Guard, just set in an art museum, and several characters travel through time and have experiences through a painting of Homer and through other famous classical paintings. And we're going to do that in rep with Red, which is a play about Rothko.
So did you put up your hand, Gabe, and say, I'd like to direct the Steve Martin? How does that work?
If somebody comes forward with a proposal, this is the play, this is how it should be done, and I would like to direct it, Thomas will take that into consideration. Otherwise, they're just plays that seem like a good fit. And in this case, yeah, Thomas reached out to me and said, would you be interested in directing this? To which I said, yes, of course. Because when we read it, I was very excited. I remember when it opened in New York City and all the buzz around the fact that Steve Martin thinks he's a playwright.
Oh, he's a bluegrass musician.
Right, yeah. Steve Martin, I have a lifelong love for Steve Martin. I remember seeing him on TV specials, and then I'd stay up really late at night when my parents were in bed and watch him on Saturday Night Live. And one night, our local classic rock radio station had an album night where they would play an album from beginning to end. And one Wednesday night, they played Let's Get Small. And I'm in my bedroom with my transistor radio under the pillow, the earplug in my ear, and I'm biting my pillow because I'm laughing so hard. And okay, I was young back then. I knew Abbott and Costello. I knew, comedians who'd come up and tell jokes and ba-dum-bumps. And I'm like, this is funny, but I don't understand why. And that was my introduction to absurdist comedy, which informs my understanding of absurdist theater.
Well, one of the things that's very timely in terms of your theme and the power of art in our lives, we know that often it is the artists and the playwrights and the creative folks who have an antenna up and they sort of get a sense of the culture and what's going on. And certainly we get a sense of that with the painters around the time of Picasso, the Cubists, and all Leger, and all of those folks who were really tuned into the disruptions in Europe and the violence and the pending wars. And so it really is worthwhile exploring that period in art. But at the same time, there's a revolution in physics. And so, how do they
Exactly.
speak to each other, right?
Sure. Well, when people ask me what the play's about, I say Einstein and Picasso walk into a bar, which is literally the premise of the play. The Le Pan Agile is a bar that's popular with artists, writers, bohemians, art dealers, that kind of folk, plus regular people. And they all just spend time together and they all talk to each other and argue with each other like people do and form opinions. And so that's a big part of this particular play. So 1904, you're right. It is a time of shifting plates in terms of the culture and the continent of Europe. And the notion that Einstein and Picasso, I mean, they could have been in a bar together and they would have spoken to each other, right? And it's funny you mentioned an antenna up. The first line of the play is, there's something in the air tonight.
There it is. Do we know what drew Steve Martin to this premise?
Yeah, no, he said in an interview that he was interested in the idea of how Picasso's vision of art tracked to Einstein's theories of relativity. And he was very interested in a conversation about the relative importance of art versus science and could they be reconciled? But ultimately, there's a hoi polloi kind of goal. He clearly wanted to make his audience laugh.
And so, is there a plot? Now, everybody's talking, but it's not talking heads about philosophy, or is it?
No. Well, I told the cast, understand, guys, there's almost no plot here. A bunch of people show up in a bar and they start to argue about random different things. So the only thing that's happening is your performance. So you need to keep this moving and energized and escalating because it's not like the door opens and, like, stop, there's been a murder.
That would happen in Steve Martin's current TV show, Stop, There's Been a Murder,
yes.
Right?
More often than he and Martin Short like.
Well, we do know that there is Tom Stoppard, and Tom Stoppard did a lot of writing about bringing the physicists together and Arcadia and what's going on. So this is in that tradition?
Yes, yeah, sort of. I mean, I think the conversations that are happening in this play are more about Picasso and Einstein being young men in a hurry. They know that what they're doing is relevant, is significant. They know, they feel they're on the verge of a breakthrough. They believe they will get recognition for this. And when these two egos come in the same room, the first thing they do is fight with each other. Picasso in particular dismisses Einstein like, oh, you're just a scientist. All you want is theories. And Einstein has to make his case that, no, what I'm doing is the pursuit of beauty.
Does it come up at all that Einstein actually was a violinist?
It doesn't come up in the play. It really kind of just lets Einstein be a nerdy math guy, but who is the first one when he's hearing Picasso speak, going, oh my God, I can't believe what you're saying. This idea that a thing could be changed by how you're perceiving it and yet still remain the same thing. And so Einstein's the first one that starts to say, hey, wait a second, I think we're on the same page.
Are there images? He can't pull out his cell phone and show everybody what he's been doing. Are they supposedly knowing what he's been doing, or does he describe
it? Yeah, he's at the end of his famous blue period. So he's a known artist in Paris right now. And a young woman named Suzanne comes in and says, is Picasso going to be in here tonight? And they're like, maybe, why? Do you know him? Yes, twice. And she has a sketch that he did of her, and then in the bar comes a character named Sago, who is the historical Clovis Sago, the art dealer, who was an early supporter and promoter of Picasso. And he sees the sketch and he goes, want to sell it to me? And when she says, no, I'll never sell it, he said, well, at least get it signed so it'll be worth more.
People drift in, drift out, they're regulars there, barflies and things like that.
Yes. Yeah, Freddie the bartender, his girlfriend Germaine, and of course, the barfly Gaston.
And what about working with actors who are portraying real historical figures, Picasso, Einstein? We know what they look like. We may have seen them in documentaries, that sort of thing. How do you talk to actors about that?
Sure. Well, the first thing I told them is I'm not overly concerned about accents. This is a play set in Paris, so I told them, I don't need you all to learn to do French accents. However, with Einstein and Picasso, because they're not French, I said, if you can do an accent, that would be appropriate. And the two actors portraying them, they did the work. They had about a month before we started rehearsing, and they came in with really good accents. So I was very happy about that. I got to work with our costumer, Marie Andrews, who is a big lover of fashion history. And so we looked at the time period, and I brought photos of Einstein and Picasso and Sago, how they seemed to dress. And she took those ideas and found what she could to dress the characters.
It's always good to have that conflict. The first thing they do is fight. No, ego, ego. And they both
must.
Oh,
yeah, yeah.
Right?
There's a lot of that.
Is there any action in terms of anybody standing up and walking across the stage? Do they just stay at the bar?
Oh, they don't just sit on bar stools and talk. No, part of the energy of the scenes helps propel the blocking. As a director, I like to use blocking to help create relationships, like who is dominating right now, who's confronting. And so yeah, it's not everybody kind of sitting at their table and drinking. They move around a lot, and not just move to move. There's one point where there's a dance-off between Picasso and Einstein where they keep grabbing the same woman and dancing with her across the stage.
Is the music then that Paris Salon type that we would think at Montmartre and that sort of thing?
Yep. There's that, and there's some surprises, too. And I don't want to give any spoilers, but towards the end of the play, a visitor arrives from the future.
Time travel.
Oh, yeah.
If it's Steve Martin, then we know it's going to be
one weird thing after another, until we get to the end. And a character says, isn't it interesting how the play fit perfectly between when the lights came up and the lights went down? There's a lot of absurdity in this. Things happen. There are definitely things that wouldn't have happened in Paris in 1904.
Do we get a little sense then that Steve is playing with quantum physics in a certain
yes.
sense?
Yes. Yeah, I kind of like to think he just put a lot of ideas in a pot. He stewed it, thought about it, tasted it, put things up to see what would be funny, and he came up with this very interesting play that does have these interesting ideas kind of in contact with each other and abridging each other and fitting together in certain ways. But you know, this is not a treatise. We don't come out at the end going, oh, I understand now.
Does Picasso, for example, if he's being funny, does he think of himself as being funny? Does Einstein, if he's being funny, does he think of himself?
You have a weird ability to predict what this play contains. There is a line that says, Picasso, you're the least funny among us. What do you think of this joke? Picasso says, what do you mean? I'm funny. This is young Picasso. He's in love with himself. What we get from him at the very beginning is that everything's coming up Picasso, as far as he's concerned, which is why he abides no idea that anybody else might be as important as he is. You know, he also is a notorious womanizer. So is Einstein, but, you know, and those sexual entanglements are also part of the plot. Einstein announces he's here waiting for a woman, and she shows up, and we get the sense that she's also paying his meals and his housing and everything else.
Now, does young Einstein have that kind of flyaway hair?
The character says, no, you can't be Albert Einstein. He says, wait a moment. There, now do it look right?
Steve Martin is self-aware about that kind of thing.
Exactly.
Right?
It's like, remember when you first saw Monty Python? And like, so I was young, so that my first time I watched it, I'm like, what is this? And then it came back the next week and I watched it again, and I began to realize, oh yeah, that's funny because of who Karl Marx is.
I hope you're having fun with it, it sounds like.
Having a lot of fun. And I got a great cast. They are so committed. My wife tells me I work them way too hard, but they all tell me this is the favorite part of their day. So I'm like, okay, good, because you're going to come back tomorrow. I mean, there's just a lot to work out and a lot of precision to get to. You know, a comedy is so much about timing, rhythms, back and forth. Everybody needs to understand, I'm saying this, this is why I'm saying it, this is why I'm reacting this way. And the audience laughs, not because there's punchlines, but because they understand these characters and they recognize what's happening. So it's not just a matter of knowing your lines and your blocking, right? There's what I always call your mental blocking, and we have to map all that out too.
Now, you are in your bed and you're biting your fist, so you aren't going to give away that you're laughing about that long-form comedy record of Steve Martin. Is there any sense that even in those days when you were young and he was young, that this was someone who could write and you didn't think at that time he was going to write a play, but that there was that sense that he could keep the narrative going in a way for that piece?
I probably didn't think about it that way. Because I was like young. I think I was like 12 or 13 years old. But I definitely realized that this was new. This was not a kind of comedy I was used to. And that newness and that smartness about it really excited me. And so then when, you know, he made his first movie, The Jerk, which again, what a strange, strange movie and yet hilarious. And like, I want more of this. And Martin's career, he had an opportunity to really create some very personal, weird, unique comedy movies. They did okay. I think now they're mostly cult classics. But you know, when he got to the point where he was getting hired to basically be the Spencer Tracy of the 80s and 90s, that edge kind of went away. And you know, and so at that point, I was like, okay, go make another $1 million, Steve. Especially because every now and then he'd come out and do something like The Spanish Prisoner. I still respect you, but I think I'm not going to see The Father of the Bride Part 2. So when he came out with a novel, Shop Girl, I went to the library and got a copy and read it. And I was like, okay, this is interesting. He's really trying to do something literary. This is not necessarily a comic novel. It isn't really at all. And I was like, okay, he's a guy thinking, what haven't I done that I think I could do if I try hard enough? And so some things happened, and then out came Picasso with the Le Panagieux, and I think he found, like, okay, here's how I can live in this space.
What was the critical reaction when the play came out?
I think it was mixed, if I remember correctly. Some people were like, well, okay, nice try, good luck. People said it was funny, but I think understanding that it was pushing towards some kind of dramatic seriousness, maybe some people felt it wasn't there. Maybe now that we're well out of the 20th century, when I watch this play, because that's another major theme. What is the 20th century and who is going to define it? That sort of ambiguity in its ending is appropriate to me, because you know, we look back and you know, there's nostalgia, but there's also like, we were crazy bad people, weren't we?
After immersing yourself in the play as you do to bring it to life for us, what are your thoughts as you come away having had this conversation with Steve Martin as a playwright? What are you thinking? Have you thought any differently or just brought you back to thoughts about what the role of art and the arts, the role of art is in our lives?
Yeah, I do narrative arts, the dramatic arts. I'm focused on telling stories. And when we tell stories, we define ourselves, or we try to define ourselves. Art in narrative tries to get us to experience something we are not, so that your experience is broadened by things you haven't done in your own life. So the importance of storytelling as powerful enough to be heard by a large group of people creates empathy and brings people to a place where they can sort of understand each other, where in our current moment, people don't do that. You know, people go to their silo, sit there and grouse about those guys over there, you know, and there's not a lot of opportunities for us to come together to tell a story together. That's the story of community theater. That's what we're doing here, right? As far as Picasso at the Le Panagil goes, you know, it's the 20th century, if we were going to really be high level, was about this idea that reality and perception impact each other somehow. And that if you have the creative imagination to say, just because I'm seeing it on doesn't mean there isn't something to the side that is also part of this person. And so when I draw, I can pull all of it forward. And that's actually a better portrait of what's really in front of me. And of course, Einstein's telling us, sure, everything looks straight, but that's because we're standing on this rock that is flying through the galaxy around a sun, which is spinning around. And the very idea that gravity is not a force, it's just us falling along with the planet together, you know, and that light bends. Everything in these ideas gives us a 20th century that ought to have had this kind of broader vision and recognized that people were looking at the same thing, just in different ways. But instead, the conflicts were like, no, this is the right way to look. And I got the power to make that be the case.
Well, give us the particulars then.
All right. So Picasso at the Le Panagil is a bar. Panagil is at the Warehouse Theater in Wellsboro, Pennsylvania. We open Friday, February 20th, 7:30 p.m. Then again on the 21st, 27th, and 28th. We're also doing Sunday matinees on Sunday, February 22nd. And Sunday, March 1st. Come on the 27th. You can celebrate my birthday with me.
Candles. What's your favorite kind of cake? Okay.
Cool. If you laugh, I'll consider myself well treated.
One more thing, Gabe. In the course of getting ready for it, did you go back and look at the work that Picasso was doing in his blue period?
Yeah.
What'd you find?
I looked at that. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, he was definitely playing with dimensions. There was some flattening happening. You could see a line going from Matisse and Van Gogh. Painters became less interested in this sort of realistic representation and were more interested in the act of painting. And those ideas, as we know, continue all the way into the 50s and 60s. But what changed for Picasso, it's hard to describe. It's like it opened up and they just became bigger. And the shapes became beautiful but strange. And in the play, Picasso says, it used to be I'd have an idea, and then months later I could do it. It would take months for me to be able to do what I was thinking. He said, now it's minutes away. And he says, and then one day there will be no separation. It will be simultaneous. So he was breaking down a whole lot of things in order to just get beyond what he thought a painting should be and paint. The painting that is significant is Les Demoiselles d'Avignon, which is a portrait of five women dancing, maybe they're lying. We can't tell if they're standing upright or if they're lying down on the ground. But this painting, when he exhibited it, it created a huge stir because the art critics are like, this is insane. This is not a painting. This is from when I was a kid. A kindergartner could have done that. To which you have to say, but why didn't they? And that painting actually features in the play as well. So we had to get licensing from the Picasso estate in order to bring this to the stage somehow. I mean, Hamilton Gibson, we tried to keep our budgets reasonably small. And the idea that you're going to buy something or pay for something that you can only use once, you really have to justify that. And in my case, I thought I had the justification. It's about the moment before this comes into the world. This has to be represented. And because it's about artists, we need to respect the artist and his family and ask for their permission.
Gabe Hochrug, who is vice president of the board of Hamilton Gibson Productions, a theater company in Wellsboro, Pennsylvania. He is director of the current show, Picasso at the Lapin Agile, and that's by Steve Martin. The show opens tomorrow evening in the Warehouse Theater, and shows running Fridays and Saturdays, February 20th, 21st, 27th, and 28th at 7:30 p.m., and Sundays, February 22nd and March 1st at 2:30. So two weekends, this weekend and next, Fridays and Saturdays at 7:30 p.m., Sundays at 2:30. For more information on the web, hamiltongibson.org, hamiltongibson.org. Picasso at the Lapin Agile by Steve Martin, presented by Hamilton Gibson Productions, this weekend and next in the Warehouse Theater in Wellsboro. HamiltonGibson.org.